to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. We have two guests today. First, Elizabeth Sartoris will talk with us about the broader evolutionary context for what's going on in the world right now and what we can learn from nature about both how we can organize our society and how we can strengthen our immune system to stay healthy in the face of the pandemic. Following that, we'll talk with Harold Meyerson about the attempted coup at the Capitol yesterday and the election of two U.S. senators in Georgia this week. Our first guest, Dr. Elizabeth Sartoris, is an internationally known evolution biologist and futurist, speaking on all five continents, teaching living economies, and how to navigate our perfect storm of crises. She is currently a professor in residence at Chaminade University in Honolulu. Dr. Sartoris is the author of Earth Dance, Living Systems and Evolution, A Walk Through Time, From Stardust to Us, Biology Revisioned, and her latest book, Gaia's Dance, The Story of Earth and Us. Dr. Elizabeth Sartoris, welcome to All Together Now.
Aloha from Honolulu.
Aloha. Make me jealous. It's freezing here in Washington, D.C. In addition to a coup, we have the cold winter, so I'm jealous of your great weather there in Hawaii.
What a historic moment you're going through.
Yeah, it's really an incredible moment. And my daughter's car got smashed. The window got smashed. And I don't know if it was the Proud Boys or... But it's just kind of a climate of violence. It kind of makes violence more acceptable, but very unsettling. So, and we're living in very unsettling times. I mean, it's just one thing after another. It's the pandemic, it's the economy, it's our democracy. And you're a longtime observer in kind of the evolution of humanity. You see a bigger time frame than most of us do. What do you see happening now? Is this like the collapse of human civilization, or is this kind of like the downside that allows for the recreation at a higher level?
Well, let me say first, Eleanor, thank goddess for Georgia, the only saving grace of yesterday. And we are very much in what I say is the last gasp of 6,000 years of empire building.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it.
Well, and the end of, you know, the falling of an empire is never a pretty thing. Mm-hmm. And we are going through that big time right now, right here in the United States. You can kind of pretend you're not in the middle of it out here in the middle of the ocean, but we do feel the seismic waves. So from an evolutionary perspective, there are so many things going through. I used to say, as an evolution biologist, humanity is designing for itself more suicide weapons than I could ever have imagined. Mm-hmm. And I hear a lot of people talking about the revenge of nature against us, Gaia's revenge. And I say, no, we have to take 100% of the responsibility, because we claim to be consciously evolution, evolving. Mm-hmm. And so it is all our problem. And of course, the biggest one is climate change. Mm-hmm. And that is related to the COVID crisis now, because the more we destroy ecosystems, the more the viruses that are adapted within an ecosystem, the toughest ones have to jump on us as lifeboats. We're the ones in there wrecking it. And so we see viruses coming from bats or whatever animals, right? Monkeys in the jungle that we're not adapted to. The evolutionary matter of the microcosm is supremely important right now, because there is no creature ever to evolve on Earth that did not evolve with its contingent of microorganisms, in particular bacteria and their communication system, the viruses. Every one of your 50 trillion cells spits out viruses like dandruff 24/7. People are not aware of that. They don't know that coronaviruses have already been built into our DNA. What we do know is that it took us 30 years to go from seeing all bacteria as evil germs to recognizing that we can't live without them, that we have 10 times as many bacteria as body cells, they're that much smaller, coating our insides and outsides and keeping us healthy. They make our vitamins, they repair our gut linings, and they run 80% of the immune system. So 30 years of making war on bacteria with antibiotics, which in Greek means anti-life agents, we finally came to respecting the vast majority of bacteria as beneficial and necessary to us. We cannot afford to wait 30 years to discover the same thing about viruses. And we must learn to live with them in harmony. Many people around the world are being cured rather quickly and easily of this COVID disease with long-tested drugs and vitamins. And this is not getting out to the public at large. Some whole countries are giving free self-medication kits, like El Salvador, for instance. The young president there bought 26 million cases. 26 million kits, COVID kits. You can Google those online and find out exactly what's in them. And they're having very, very good success with it. So we have a lot to learn. And the most important thing that we know that all of us can work on is that our gut bacteria and their viruses are responsible for our immune systems, and healthy immune systems are the best defense against this virus.
Wow, that is so fascinating. And I'm so happy to provide a forum for you to talk about this, because I have never heard any of that. And the whole framing of this pandemic with the COVID-19 has been literally a war, that we're at war with this virus and we're going to defeat this virus. And I don't know enough about biology, much less evolutionary biology, to challenge that, but it just felt like something was off with that metaphor. And we tend to instinctively go to like war mode. So say a little bit more, because what you're offering, a complete reframing of how we think about this coronavirus. And so you said, for example, we've got the coronavirus in our DNA. Like, how is that possible? Like, I thought the coronavirus was a new thing, but you're saying, no, we already have it there.
It is well known that there are a lot of different kinds of coronaviruses. Corona refers to that coat on the outside. And of course, there are germ warfare laboratories in China and in the US, near Washington and in Wuhan in particular, who have been cooperating for years on what they call gain of function research. Gain of function means, how do you alter that coat to allow those viruses into cells? Because cells admit viruses. Viruses don't drill their way into cells as the animated cartoons sometimes show. The cell has to admit the virus, and viruses, kind of like mail, I said they're a communication system, have addresses on them, and certain ones are allowed in, accepted, and others aren't. So there is the possibility, because you can look back into the literature that came out of these laboratories which talk about this gain of function research, about how they are altering coronaviruses to get them into cells. So I don't want to get into the controversy of where it comes from. It isn't as important to me to know whether it naturally came out or escaped a lab or whatever. Mm-hmm. The important thing to understand is, what is the nature of our relationship to viruses? Mm-hmm. And of course, I believe this is the first disease in history that we can be tested and said to have with no symptoms. I think back to the polio days of my childhood and wonder if they had had a test then, whether we wouldn't all have tested positive, because we weren't doing any social distancing or masking, or, you know, my kids in my class got crippled, kids I played with on the playground by that disease. So there's that whole thing of the more you test, the more you will find. We know what percentage of people tested are going to test positive at this point, and that can go up and down. The Canadian doctor who's been CEA of a company in, I think, North Carolina, which makes this test, the PRN test for the viruses, for the coronavirus, this one, COVID, has come out publicly and stated this test was never intended to be diagnostic. It cannot diagnose the disease. So there are so many questions on my mind about this. And I'm an unavowed, unabashed fan of Robert Kennedy Jr. and his Children's Health Defense Fund. And his attorney and other people have done so much research into this if people want to find the evidence. We also know that talking about other suicide weapons, that 5G causes the same kind of hypoxia as the COVID disease. So they amplify each other. And they both are associated with pollution particles. That common effect is called hypoxia. It's a lack of oxygen, but not because you don't breathe it in, but rather because your red blood cells that pick up the oxygen from the lungs cannot deliver it to your cells. And so your cells are starved of oxygen. So there's a lot of interesting medical research, but I want to focus on what we can do about it ourselves, right, in terms of building our immune systems.
That's exactly right. And that's what I want for our listeners to know, because we're kind of in this war mode and kind of hunkering down and hiding in our homes, hoping we stay away from people and keep the coronavirus at bay. But it seems like there's a whole lot of things we could do besides wearing a mask and social distancing that could put us in a healthier position to be able to fight off anything that might hurt us. So what can we do? Like, what would you say for our listeners? What can we do to keep ourselves healthy in the current environment?
Well, there are a few basic things you can add to your diet. Supplements like zinc and vitamin D in particular are the most important ones. But of course, the healthy immune system depends on your diet. It depends on what you're feeding your bacteria. And unfortunately, when we hear things like Black people are more vulnerable to this virus than white people, what you're really saying is we live in a caste system. And that new book, Caste, is very good on it. And so poor people have less access to healthy food than people of moderate or great means. And so, but it is about healthy food. And what I think we need a huge public outcry about is that the biggest multinationals in the world, and I'm going to name right now Bayer. Hmm. Bayer has eaten up Monsanto. Bayer has a long chemical history going back to the early days in Germany as IG Farben, which was cooperating with the United States in the development of petrochemicals and poisonous gases and gas chambers and all kinds of things like that. Mm-hmm. And they have patented a chemical called Roundup. Most people know that. Some people mm-hmm. use it on their lawns. Please don't do that anymore. It gets into the air and poisons you. So our food fields are sprayed with this anti-life agent, this toxic chemical. All of the grains and the veggies are sprayed with it, and the rest of the antibiotics are stuffed into the animals, the poor animals in the feedlots, so that virtually all supermarket food has been toxified at great profit to these companies. And then when you get sick because they've wrecked your immune system, they make double profits and even more by selling you the pharmaceuticals and the vaccines now, which is so expensive. Why shouldn't these vaccines be as free as the COVID kits are to the people of El Salvador? There's something wrong with a very profitable sickness system that's going to keep us sick. We must fight for a healthy healthcare system, and healthy food is the first thing that we must demand. It is possible. It is cheaper and easier to grow healthy food, actually, than the toxic food of big pharma and big fields.
Right, because you don't have all those petrochemicals that you're adding on, the pesticides and fertilizers. So when you say healthy food, like, what should I be feeding my family? What should our listeners be eating to stay healthy?
Well, you know, I have written about ending the food wars because, unfortunately, those people who are very food conscious are fighting each other with the vegans, fighting the paleos and so on.
Right, exactly.
And I say, for Pete's sake, let's everybody who's fighting for healthy food get together and realize we must be on the same team and allow ourselves the diversity of choosing our particular diets. So whatever the food you eat is, if it is healthy, fresh food, the less processed, the better. The more directly it gets to your table from wherever it's grown, the better. And then choose what diet works for you. Right now, I would say I'm in a plant-based Mediterranean diet, which mm-hmm. doesn't exclude anything that isn't fresh and, you know, unprocessed.
Right, that's good. And I liked, you know, I've followed some of Michael Pollan's work, who's done a lot of research and writing about healthy food and healthy bodies. And he says, basically, if you see anything being advertised, that's not going to be a healthy food because it's going to be a processed packaged food that they're trying to sell. It's a food product. It's not really food.
So to tell people to buy it, there's something wrong with it.
Right. People know to eat food. You don't have to spend billions of dollars in ads to say, eat these crackers. So yes, I think healthy, organic, the fewer chemicals, the better. Fresh fruits and vegetables, you can't go wrong. And then there's some debate around meat. We want to have, fresh fish. There's some debate around fish even, whether we should be fishing the oceans. But, you know, it's a good, healthy food for the body, most of it. So although there's so many toxins in the fish now that if you're eating bluefish, you're picking up the mercury, toxins, whatever, in the fish. So what do you suggest to people around the meat and fish debate?
Well, I'm saying all of your food, if it has been, grown commercially in big agriculture, is toxic. So to a certain degree, to a certain extent, there are still places in the world where there are healthy fish. Some fish farming, the way it used to be done in Hawaii, was using ocean water in inland pools, you know, that were maintained and the water was circulated. You know, if you're feeding them in closed ponds, you would get toxic fish farms. So it's all about going back to natural ways. And, you know, I grew up on 100% organic food as a child in the Hudson Valley of New York State because there were no toxic chemicals. The pharmaceutical chemicals came out of the warfare. Vandana Shiva's book, The Violence of the Green Revolution, written long ago, 30, 40 years ago now, I think, did a great job of showing how the leftover nitrates that they couldn't make explosives from after the war were all turned into these artificial fertilizers. And then the seeds were GMO'd to be packaged together with the Roundup, you know, the genetically modified seeds that could resist the toxins, and everything else around them would be killed off. this is new. It's a single generation or a single lifetime ago that all of our food was not that way. And it's about 100 years ago, a bit older than me, that the Rockefellers, you know, talked all the medical schools in the country into going completely into drug-based medicine. You know, I was living in Washington, D.C., where you are, during the one Clinton inauguration to the next, roughly, at the time when I met Harriet Crosby. Hello, Harriet, if you're listening. And there outside my building at 1500 Mass Ave, four blocks from the White House, is a statue to Hahnemann, the founder of homeopathy. And I said, what is a statue of the founder of homeopathy, a natural medicine kind of system, doing in the nation's capital? Well, that's when I did the homework and found out that the medical schools across the country were teaching homeopathy and osteopathy and other more natural ways. And everyone was eating organic food. And now we have, you know, we in the richest country in the world have one of the poorest records in our healthcare system, and in child, even in infant mortality, we're not up at the top where we should be. So we have to look back at our relationship with nature, in particular its microworld, and get with it that if we're going to survive this climate change, and we have no way now of stopping what we have tipped the balance on Earth to, then our species is going to be cut back dramatically. I think that's highly likely. And the way I keep up my optimism is to tell everyone I reach, you and your loved ones can be among the surviving generations if you get it right now, if you start finding ways to get the healthiest possible food and living off the beaches and up on higher ground, and get yourselves together in communities, develop the local scripts, the money systems that were developed after the Great 29 Depression to build your local economies. Look at organizations like BALLE, B-A-L-L-E, Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. Judy Wicks started that in Philadelphia when we were talking with each other about my living systems approach and her community organizing skills. And so there are resources all over. There's a Global Eco Village Network, GEN, the Global Eco Village Network. There are so many resources and places in the world, from the Mondragon cooperatives in Spain to the Sarvadia movement in Sri Lanka, where self-development and community organizing and local currencies and all those things can be looked to for resources. My favorite Rumi quote is, why do we stay in prison when the door is so wide open? We know what to do.
Well, with your guidance, we know some of what we can do, and appreciate all that insight there. And so you've mentioned that all these crises, and you're so right, we're so unhealthy in the United States. I'm actually writing a book now about our four major crises and what we can do about them, which is our health first, of course, and the climate problem, our economy, and our democracy. And of course, they're all interwoven. But I'm trying to map a pathway of how do we move forward to deal with this multiple systems breakdown that we're facing. And I was shocked to learn that the majority of people in the United States are unhealthy. Even before this coronavirus came with the COVID-19, more than half of Americans suffer from a major health problem, like diabetes, heart disease, cancer, you know, so being very sick is the norm in the United States right now. And that's what I've seen, is so much of it comes from food and from exercise or lack of exercise. And just if we could get those two things right, we could strengthen our bodies more to deal with the coronavirus and all kinds of other challenges that we've got to our health. So I appreciate your focus on that. So what do you see as the opportunity here? You know, we've got these big national and global crises. Where's the daylight?
Yes, when you walk through a storm, hold your head up high. There's golden light. There's a golden light at the end of the storm. Right.
No, exactly. And my favorite quote that I discovered in 2019 when I was up at Cape May was, don't complain that it's raining. Learn how to dance in the storm.
Yes, exactly. And here in Hawaii, we use a lot of navigator metaphors, and stand tall in your canoe is one of my favorite ones, which means raise your consciousness up high until you can see the big picture. Look at the human drama as if it's a play being played out. And it's a co-creative, it's an improv play. So you can choose your role. So don't beat your head against a wall. Don't try to get yourself to do something you hate. Become an attractor to other people. And one of my best friends here is Samoan royalty and a University of Hawaii professor. And he points out that curing a disease is very different from healing, and that aloha is about restoring balance, about healing, about caring. And the best thing I know about the COVID crisis is that we elevated caregivers to heroism status. And that to me was a wonderful thing, not to mention that when we stopped flying in the airplanes and shut our economy down, nature popped back so quickly. And the blue skies were wonderful here, and it's cleaner, greener, and quieter in Hawaii without all the tourists. But I want Hawaii to issue a state currency and boost our economy overnight. You see, this is the kind of thing that could be done. If we would issue alohas, let's say, as a digital currency, it costs nothing to issue it. Mm-hmm. And then the state would say, you can pay your state taxes in it. That would validate it. There's nothing illegal about these scripts, these alternate currencies that were used after the 29 Depression. And then pay all these unemployed hotel workers to grow organic food on government land. And then demand that the food suppliers and the landlords accept this currency, and you could kickstart the economy quickly. Hmm. But like the rest of the country, we're focused on building new condos that no one locally can afford to live in, and to bring back the tourism as quickly as possible, which again drains off all dollars earned, go out through the hotels, through the Costcos, through the WalMarts. Off island, and we need currency that stays in place locally, because then you need a lot less of the money because you keep recycling it. Mm-hmm. That's the beauty of money, is it can be used over and over and over again if you keep it local. So I think that's one of the best things we can do, is look to your local economy. How much caring and sharing can you do with each other? How much aloha can you bring to your community in a spirit of positive optimism? Don't beat your head against the wall fighting things that you can't win, and instead look for those areas where you can move ahead, whether you want to write the poetry or do the voter registration or grow the organic garden or whatever, you know, go into alternative healthcare, building people's immune systems. There are so many ways for so many inclinations. And if you're enjoying what you're doing, your crusade, you'll do it better and you'll become an attractor to other people. You'll spread that aloha.
And you'll be happier and healthier, because happy cells are healthy cells. So that's a great way to. And you had mentioned something that struck me as very unusual. Maybe you could explain it here about, but that the virus could actually become our ally. So how do you see the virus becoming our ally?
Well, in the general sense of understanding that that viruses are as friendly as bacteria are, that it's only the odd rogue, like the odd rogue human, even in a healthy society, somebody will end up stealing or causing problems or bopping someone else over the head. And we have to learn to live with that kind of variance in our natural systems. But to get over the fear and look to the friendship, to move it in that direction in general, to understand, you know, there are lots of people dying. More people are still dying of malaria than there are of COVID cases. And you know, the vulnerable people are the people my age. Because why? Because most of them are taking 25 medicines for a dozen chronic diseases. And yet they all get, as long as they get COVID on top of it, that's a COVID death. So it doesn't seem like anyone has colds or flu anymore. You don't hear about it. There are no more car accidents. There are no more other diseases. It's all focused on this one disease. And our hope that the vaccine will save us finally from it. And already, as we're issuing vaccines, we're seeing all the new strains coming in. Mm-hmm. And we can't guarantee that this vaccine will work for those strains. And we've gone from, in my infancy, a couple of inoculations for some obvious measles and tetanus and whooping cough, I think were the three. And now it's like 70 different vaccines given to babies in their first year or two. And this is going to go on and on and on? I don't think so. But in the end, I think nature is not so much having its revenge as that it's going to save us from ourselves, because we're going to be so busy scrabbling to save ourselves that we'll be able to function, we'll be able to focus on the bare survival needs for food and shelter, right? And some of the big things will go down the drain. Just 2 days ago, Ted Koppel did an op-ed, I think, on last Sunday, about the vulnerability of the internet with the new hacking coming out, and saying we live in the biggest glass house in the United States. We're the most advanced on the whole technology, the information technology. And of course, that's what 5G is about. It's not about making your a cell phone work faster. It's about data collection, and it's dangerous. The same microwave technology was first used as crowd control in the same sense that Roundup, you know, and these chemicals were used in warfare. So we have to look to that, and we have to look to saving ourselves. And what I'm saying is that the internet could go down, that the countries, as Ted Koppel said, those countries most dependent on the internet are the ones that will suffer the most.
Well, so that's,
the
I'm sorry.
Poorest countries will be best off.
Yes. Well, we could go on for hours, and I'd love to have you back and talk some more sometime. But for today, that's all the time we have. So, Dr. Elizabeth Satoris, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Eleanor. I hope you'll let me listen in on the second half.
Please. Yes, listen in.
Thank you. Thank you, and aloha to everyone.
Aloha. So for our next guest now, we have our background that I think the whole world now knows, that yesterday a mob incited by Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol, breaching security, smashing windows, and invading both the U.S. House and Senate. Their intent was to overturn the certified votes of We the People being presented yesterday to Congress. The D.C. mayor called out the National Guard and help restore order after about 5 hours, when Congress then resumed its deliberations and accepted the electoral votes officially. Here to help us understand what happened and are we going to get Trump out of office and what comes next is Harold Meyerson, editor at large of the American Prospect. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
Always good to be here, Eleanor, in a crazy time when the Washington Post today ran its story, Democrats Take Senate, on page 6, which gives you some sense of just the weight of events going on here.
Exactly. I made that comment to my husband this morning. It was like, the Democrats win 2 Senate seats in a special election in Georgia, take control of the U.S. Senate, and it's only page 6 news. So,
right.
You wrote a piece yesterday, which I really loved, at saying that Trump is responsible for bringing this crowd to D.C. and then inciting them to violence and to telling them to go attack. And he actually said he would go with them. So explain why you think Trump is responsible for this attack on the legislative branch of our government.
Well, as I said, this is the quintessence of Trumpism. You have a sociopath narcissist who has no knowledge of or regard for history or democratic small d norms. It used to be Republicans were basically only opposed to minority rights. They've kept that, but they're now also opposed to majority rule. If you get rid of both of those, I'm not quite sure what's left of democracy. But actually, I read a piece today, which should go online within the next 15 minutes of our speaking here or so, which also traced this back to being really kind of the culmination of the Republican Party's conversion over 55 years into the closest thing we've had to a neo-Confederate in the Civil War sense, a neo-Confederate party. This begins in 1964. When Lyndon Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act, and which more or less casts the historic Dixiecrat block adrift from the Democratic Party. And also in that year, when Barry Goldwater, who was one of only six Republicans to vote against the Civil Rights Act, became the Republicans' presidential nominee. And over the years, the Republican Party centered itself, recentered itself, I should say, in the white South, and, began espousing the racially and anti-democratic, rather toxic views of the white South. You know, Trump sort of re-enters, or enters, I should say, major American political dialogue when, as a private citizen, he starts pushing the racist and big lie that Barack Obama was actually born in Kenya, therefore is not a legitimate president. Look who's talking. And now he's going out having really kind of roused a rabble to invade the Capitol to stop the ratification of a presidential election, while waving Confederate flags and spewing the kind of lumpen hate that also fueled the European fascism in the 1930s. So that's my quick take.
Yeah, I think that's all right. And Trump should just be removed from office immediately. I mean, I know it's only 2 weeks to the inauguration, but really, that is the action of sedition, if not treason. And he should, you know, who knows what damage he could cause in the next 2 weeks, in addition to just be responsible for what he just did, a big stain on our democracy. I know Pelosi today is urging Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to the Constitution, which requires the vice president and a majority of the cabinet to say the president needs to be taken out immediately of office. So what do you think the prospects of getting Trump out of office are now?
Well, Pelosi said a little more than that. She said either he should invoke the 25th Amendment, or she would support an impeachment measure, which the Democratic leader in the Senate, very soon to be the majority leader, Chuck Schumer, supports as well. And so there's clearly, a groundswell for this. And by the way, getting back to your first question of Trump being responsible, there is a poll conducted last night and this morning by Politico and Morning Consult that shows majority belief that Trump is responsible for yesterday's storming of the Capitol. About 63%, I think, believe that. I think there's popular support for this. Mm-hmm. Both the 25th Amendment, invoking that, and impeachment ultimately require a two-thirds vote in both houses. I think it's quite possible they could actually get to two-thirds in the Senate. After all, no more than 8 Republican senators voted to sustain these absurd challenges that came before the Senate yesterday. On the other hand, in the House, you had about two-thirds of Republican House members supporting those challenges. And, if you look at why did the Republican Senate differ so greatly from the Republican House, it's not only because McConnell was very clear as a Republican leader in the Senate that he opposed these challenges, and that Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader in the House, supported them. Mm-hmm. It's also because most Republicans in the House come from very, very safe districts where they think it certainly won't hurt their reelection and might even help it to support Trump to the bitter end. Whereas in the Senate, You know, they didn't carve their own districts. Their districts are their states, which in even though some most there's a whole lot of states that are solidly red, it ain't as safe as a district you carved yourself, which is pretty much what is the case in the House. So legally, morally, constitutionally, is there a case to remove Trump either way? Yes. Is there a need to remove Trump either way? Absolutely yes, because who knows what kind of stuff he's capable of, mm-hmm. As he confronts something he just is not emotionally capable of confronting, which is being a loser. So are there the votes for that in the Congress? Not clear. But I think it's mandatory that at least the Democrats pursue this now, because you can't have a president threatening essentially to overthrow the American government and just sit by, even if he's only got, 13 days more in office.
No, exactly right. And I think about the 25th Amendment, which you need the vice president, you need the just a majority of the cabinet could do it. But you're saying also the ratification by 2/3 in both houses. But couldn't we get them out? Like if the cabinet and the vice president say, invoke the 25th Amendment, wouldn't he be removed? And then he could.
He has the right to appeal that to Congress.
Right.
And then it goes to a vote. But I'm not quite sure, honestly, you know, very few of us have studied the 25th Amendment, and I am one of the very many of us who has not. I'm not quite sure if he's suspended on an interim basis just to get a majority of the cabinet. By the way, I mean, who knows about the cabinet? Elaine Chao, the Secretary of Transportation, who was also Mrs. Mitch McConnell, announced her resignation today. So mm-hmm. if you have people who are opposed to Trump at this juncture, but leaving the cabinet, that means you probably have a lower chance of getting a majority of the cabinet, point one. Point two, so many at this point of his cabinet appointments are interim appointments because they haven't gone through the Senate. I mean, Homeland mm-hmm. Security, defense, you know, I mean, these have been revolving doors where he just hasn't bothered, you know, late in the game to get Senate confirmation. So it's not entirely clear to me who is officially a cabinet member and who is not, given the number of, you know, interim appointments who have not been confirmed. So there's a fuzziness around this, as there is around much of life. But again, that's not a reason not to do this and see what happens.
Right, exactly. Well, I actually thought the fact there were so many acting cabinet secretaries would help in the sense they probably don't get a vote, but the permanent ones that have been ratified by the Senate would get a vote. So you wouldn't need so many votes to get a majority of the cabinet, except that we know so many of the ones who had questions about Trump's judgment have either resigned or been fired already. So we're left with a lot of sycophants there. You'd have to go through the cabinet to see who's who. But my guess is we probably don't have the votes in the cabinet, or Elaine Chao wouldn't be resigning. She'd be staying on to vote for the 25th Amendment. And being married to Mitch McConnell, head of the he saw her resignation, that meant, you know, bye-bye to the 25th Amendment. But we could impeach him. And I think, don't we only need a majority in the House to impeach?
Yes, you only need a majority in the House. So then you don't need the 2/3. It goes to the Senate. And that is a very interesting question as to what the Senate would do. Because, you know, it's clear that it's a given, I think, that you'd get a handful of Republicans like Mitt Romney, who voted for impeachment the first time around,
right?
And this time Susan Collins. What what most of them do at this juncture is up in the air. I wouldn't bet the mortgage on Republicans, even those who have come out against Trump, going for this. But you don't know. I mean, I think it's mm-hmm. probably more a perception on their part of how much danger there is of further, you know, destructive stuff in the next fortnight, you know, than it is of that would have to overcome their reluctance to impeach a president who they have essentially supported in office for almost the entirety of his first term, of his one and only term.
Right, we hope. I think that's our best shot at, you know, we got the majority Democrats in the House. Some Republicans might join. They charge impeachment. The trial happens in the Senate. Now, the first time Trump was impeached, the Republicans dragged that out. So it went on and on. But they could do it very rapidly. I mean, they could just do a very quick trial and conviction and boom, he'd be out. So
indeed. Well, I'd have to if you know, if it
if
were
it's going to matter.
Yeah. Yeah. And if they delay it, then, you know, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. And then I think there's also responsibility galore on this mess that happened and this spectacle yesterday, including the Republican senators who aided and abetted this unfounded charges that the election was thrown to Joe Biden, which, of course, we all know there's no evidence. 90 judges have looked at the evidence in court. Not one of them has said there's a foundation for concern about fraud here. So when the push came to shove and they actually voted, it turned out about 7 of the 13 Republican senators who said they were going to challenge the electoral votes for Biden, only 7 of them actually did, but 7 is too many. And, yeah. You know, is there anything we can do to hold these guys accountable?
Well, as I noted in my piece, it's going to be posted today. Josh Hawley is sort of in the proud Missouri tradition of Quantrill's Raiders and the Jesse James gang, which were both white supremacists running, you know, causing violent havoc. I think the consequences for Hawley and for Ted Cruz, who were the two chief instigators on the Senate side, and had they not been, it's not at all clear that there would have been challenges that would have, you know, even been heard in yesterday's process, because you need the support of a senator as well as of a House member to have a challenge heard. I think, you know, they are now toxic to some percentage, I do not know what, of the Republican Party, A, and B, since they're both planning on running for president in 2024, they kind of divide the base that is, you know, blindly pro-Trump. I don't know that there's going to be any consequence, you know, other than the difficulties they have now heaped on their own ambitions. And of course, it was their own ambitions which caused them to take these actions in the first place. By the way, by sort of preempting the insane pro-Trump political space, I think they therefore compelled other Republican 2024 hopefuls to be more responsible than they otherwise would have, including Tom Cotton, who wants to run in 2024, but mm-hmm. came out against the challenges because these two guys had already come out for it. So we shall see.
That's a great analysis. And there's also some responsibility to be shared by the U.S. Capitol Police. And
boy, is there.
I've been very disturbed to see. For I was wondering, how did these guys, I've been at demonstrations at the Capitol. It is, if they don't want you to get through, you can't get through. But I've been very disturbed to see videos today of the Capitol Police actually opening the barricades and waving the rioters to come in, and other videos of the security guards like holding doors open for the rioters to get into the Capitol building
and taking selfies of themselves with the rioters.
Well, right.
A couple of things. First of all, I think it's could well be the case that they were under orders by the head of the Capitol Police to not, you know, treat them harshly. A. Mm-hmm. A lot of cops are pretty rotten and, you know, share the belief systems of the kind of people who broke into the Capitol yesterday. And so I think, you know, their bosses are, you know, Nancy Pelosi is already one of their bosses and Chuck Schumer is about to become the other of their bosses. And I would assume that not only will a number of them be fired, but I would hope since they basically aided and abetted a slew of very illegal actions, that a lot of them are prosecuted. You know, and to say this is a double standard compared to police treatment of, say, Black Lives Matter demonstrators over the past year is to state the obvious, but we shouldn't shun stating the obvious when it's true.
Right. And we know the Speaker of the House, Pelosi, today has called on the head of the U.S. Capitol Police to resign, which I think is a good beginning. But I'm actually very concerned about the safety of our members of the House and the Senate when you have that kind of breach of security and that kind of collusion between the so-called security guards and the rioters who were violently trying to disrupt the activities of the House and Senate. So let's hope that the head does resign and those participating and found to be aiding and abetting the rioters are not only fired, but prosecuted and put in jail.
So, yes, I got an email today from a close friend of mine in Brooklyn who lives down the block in Brooklyn from Chuck Schumer, whose home is in Brooklyn. And she noted, the reason she sent the email was that there was, police now surrounding his house, as has never been the case before, signaling, that in Donald Trump's America, his political opponents could be, subject to a violent attack.
Right. On happier news, as we mentioned briefly at the beginning, two great victories for the Democrats in Georgia, of all places. Again, going statewide Democrat, we get a Black preacher and a Jewish journalist, now Reverend Warnock and John Ossoff, as the incoming senators from Georgia. How did the Democrats pull that off in that very red, not known to be enlightened state?
Well, what's obvious, given how close Stacey Abrams' gubernatorial run 2 years ago was, despite substantial voter suppression, and from the outcome of the presidential race a couple months ago, and now these Senate races, is that Georgia isn't a red state anymore. It's a purple state. And part of that is, there are two elements in this. Part of that is simple demographic transformation. The share of the state that is people of color has grown substantially. So that is a necessary but not sufficient condition to this kind of transformation. I should add that also the Atlanta metro area has been getting a lot of millennials of all races moving in from the north and elsewhere. So that's part of the demographic transformation. But the other part of it is what's close to a 10-year project of voter mobilization that Stacey Abrams has spearheaded that really has, organized and organized again and organized again this potential new Georgia coalition to get to the polls. And I was seeing some reports that some of these folks received as many as 10 in-person encounters get out the vote voter mobilization folks just since the summer and it takes that kind. So and in a sense this is sort of a microcosmic version of what Republicans are so scared of and what the Republican base is so scared of, that the demographic transformation of the United States, that the great third wave of immigrants plus higher rates of African-American voter participation, plus the very clear leftism of young Americans under 35 and under 30, who are probably the leftmost generation in American history, put all that together and, Republicans face a significant peril, which they have pitched to themselves as endangering the supremacy of white America, male America, Christian America, straight America, you name it. That is part of the underlying fear that motivates a lot of Donald Trump support, but beyond Donald Trump support, even just non-Donald Trump Republican support.
Great analysis. And I also saw, I mean, you mentioned about the organizing, Stacey Abrams, hats off to her. I interviewed my friend, State Senator Nan Orrick of Georgia recently, and I asked her, how did Biden win in Biden-Harris win in Georgia? And she said, Stacey Abrams, she's been at it for 10 years and we owe it all to her. Her strategy, she did the fundraising, she knew it was possible, had the vision, built the organization, did the organizing. And of course, lots of people helped out with that. Millions of people actually helped out with that. But there's also kind of a quality to the work done in organizing for these two senators that I really love about getting people together with food and with music and making kind of community events, which led to Van Jones saying yesterday that he called it the election in Georgia, the triumph of Black joy over white rage, which I thought was was really good. So now that we have those two Senate seats, like how much does that change? I mean, obviously now the Democrats are at 50 with Vice President Harris, that'll make the 51. The Democrats are in the majority. Is that, how much is that going to help Biden get his legislation passed through Congress?
Well, first of all, it helps him get his appointments through, because that only takes 51 votes. And judges only take 51 votes. So the blockade that Mitch McConnell had placed on Democratic nominees for judges is now lifted. And I think one of the reasons he waited, Biden waited until after Georgia to announce the appointment of Merrick Garland from the DC Court of Appeals as Attorney General, is that he had no assurance that he could fill that seat on the DC Court of Appeals. Now he can. It only takes that 51 votes. As to policy, it gets tricky. There's a lot of economic policies you can wrap up into budget reconciliation that only takes 51 votes. Everything else takes 60. Now, a lot of Democrats in the Senate are willing to scrap the filibuster. Some have said they're against it. Biden has said he doesn't want to do it. I think probably what happens is something absolutely essential gets shot down by the Republicans on something that requires 60 votes. And then, you know, they may be compelled to try to move to scratch the filibuster, which I think you can actually do on individual pieces of legislation as well as a general Senate rule.
Right. So we shall you can see. Suspend the rule.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the opposition to majority rule in America, it wasn't just manifested yesterday at in the mob at the Capitol. It's hardwired into a lot of our rules and a lot of our laws and so on. And so Biden and the Democrats will have to grapple with what they want to do about that in the upcoming congressional session.
Right. Well, looking forward to the appointments by Biden. I'm sure every one of them will be light years ahead of anyone that Trump ever put in there. So we're looking forward to a better cabinet. And news came out today about the likely nomination of Mayor Marty Walsh of Boston to be Labor Secretary. And I love Marty. You know, so he was a friend of mine when I lived in Boston. I knew him before he was even a state rep. That was before he was mayor. What do you think of Marty Walsh as our Labor Secretary?
I think it's a really smart appointment. You know, there was no one in Biden's cabinet until Marty Walsh, who came clearly from the white working class, the long ago base of the Democratic Party, now in many ways the base of the Republican Party. But Marty Walsh headed the Building Trades Council in Boston and really pushed them to become something that most Eastern building trades aren't, which is heavily, you know, to represent in fair proportion minorities, women, and so on in the trades. And he pushed through the Boston City Council legislation requiring that on all major construction projects in Boston as well. I mean, I sort of see him in, you know, as both bringing, to the degree he's had control over those constituencies, bringing them into the 21st century, but also as a kind of outreach figure to this constituency, which once was Democratic and is no longer, and advocating, you know, showing that he can advocate for their interests very powerfully and for the interests of the broader working class, which is not simply white and male anymore, to put it mildly.
Fantastic. Well, that's all the time we have. I so appreciate your brilliant analysis. And Harold Morrison, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, as always, Eleanor.